helpful. But anyway, this is from Mark's Gospel, chapter 4. And we read, "The same day, when evening had come, Jesus said, 'Let us cross over to the other side.' And when they had sent away the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. And he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, 'Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing?' And he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.' And the wind ceased and there was a great calm. And he said to them, 'Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?' And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, 'What kind of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" Well, there we are. We'll look together at that passage a little later, but it is my great privilege to introduce to you Jeremy Marshall. Shall we give him a warm welcome? Well, now, Jeremy, we know you're a banker. I'm quite interested to know, you know, what sort of characteristics does a banker have? Are you sort of, I don't know what's the word, are you obsessive? Let me just I'll take a random example. How many times have you read the stories of the Ring?
The Lord of the Rings, you mean?
Yes, all of
them. Someone's been briefing you, Roger.
Have
I can see that, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, about 40 times, yeah.
40 times, yeah. Okay. So obsessive nature
give me a trivia question on Tolkien, I'll...
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. Is that right? So this is your mastermind theme, okay. Well, here's your start... No, that's a different subject. And presumably you were brilliant at maths when you were at school.
I'm afraid not, actually. And some of you are old enough to remember that they used to have O-levels and A-levels, and in between it there were AO-levels. Any of you remember those? Well, I'm the proud holder of a grade U in AO Maths. That probably, you know, confirms a number of your fears about why the banks are in a mess. However, I at least I'm not the worst mathematician in my family, because I've got three sisters, and we're all absolutely appalling at maths. I mean, really terrible. One of them, who might be here tonight, when she was getting married, she saw that the shop selling bridesmaids' dresses gave 10% off. So she thought, well, if all five of the bridesmaids go, they'll get 50% off.
And they're teachers. Okay.
She's a historian.
Oh, she's a historian.
That explains it, yeah.
Okay, so you're obsessive, but you're not good at maths, but you're still a banker. Have you ever been fired?
Yeah, I have.
Oh,
Not... Not for reading Tolkien, but I should be working, I hope, though. No, that was quite a, you know, the city is an interesting place, and it's kind of, in a way, I guess a lot of businesses like that, a sort of, you know, hire and fire environment. So one time, not at the place I'm working now, obviously I wouldn't be there, but at another bank, for about a year, every day more or less, people came to me and said, do you know you're going to be fired? So I said, after a bit, it's beginning to become a bit of a joke, really. I said, yes, absolutely, I do know. So eventually, you know, it's sort of a strange experience, really, living with a sword of Damocles over your head. And then eventually, you know, the sword fell and, you have... Actually, it wasn't quite like this, but you're meant to be. You kind of get a tap on your shoulder and you turn round. Now you have someone from HR and a security guard with a black sack. And then you're kind of shown the door.
All right. So you've experienced life. Why did you go into banking?
Do you want the truth?
Please.
Yeah, no, as we come on to in a minute, I come from a background with no, you know, money at all, despite the august bank I work for now. So I think, honestly, I was attracted to money. I mean, I think that's why a number of people go into the city, although I know obviously most people who go into the city say they go there to help society, ho-ho, and you know, generally promote the public good. Money is a powerful draw.
But it is other people's money. Did you not realise that?
Well... That may...
Oh, sorry, you're a banker.
Yeah, that's
no,
right.
I really...
That may explain 2008, yeah. I've been wondering about that issue,
absolutely.
Roger.
Yeah. All right. So did you start at the very bottom?
Yes, I did, yeah. I started on a graduate training program. And kind of, I started... My first job was Barclays North Finchley. And my kind of first entry into banking, the first week I was there, the heating wasn't working in the branch. And the only heater was in the branch manager's office, sort of like Captain Mannering. And every time someone opened the door, he'd yell, "Shut the door, you're letting all the cold air in." So that was the sort of extent of teamwork in Barclays North Finchley. And actually, it was kind of downhill from then on, really.
And now you're the CEO of it's a private bank, really. What's it called?
You obviously haven't read up your notes, Roger. Yeah.
I just go by gossip.
That's all right. No, don't worry. So, I'm chief executive of C. Hoare & Co. So it's the UK's oldest bank. I'm not here to pitch the bank, but if any of you want to sign up afterwards, you can see me.
Well, just a minute. How much, if we were going to sign up, how much do we need to put in to begin with?
Well, looking at a jacket like that, Roger, in your case, quite a bit, I think.
That's the sort of idea I'd
so,
got.
So, we're still owned by the Hoare family, who founded the bank in 1672. And we're on the 11th generation of family ownership. Seven family members own the bank. I'm the first ever non-family chief executive. But I must say, it's a great place to work. The family are an absolute pleasure and a joy to work with. They're unusual in that we're the only bank in the UK that has unlimited personal liability. Do you know what that means?
I do. It sounds good.
Do you want to explain it?
Well, I presume that if I lost everything, you'd cover me.
It's sort of the other way around, actually.
Oh, is it?
So the way it works is that if you own shares in the bank and the bank goes under, you are personally liable down to the shirt on your back to meet the debts of the bank.
Right. Okay.
And funnily enough, all other banks in the UK also used to have unlimited liability, but for reasons that slightly escaped me, they all gave it up. Mm. I wonder why.
I wonder why, yes, indeed.
And the other thing about the bank that's really unusual, and which I must say I really enjoy, is that the bank has this very, very strong philanthropic history. We were chatting earlier about Ian Hislop's...
Yeah, he did that series of television programmes about the origins of banking, and it seems as though many of the banks had that strong Christian, as you say, philanthropic sort of attitude to life when they commenced, anyway.
That's right. Ironically, one of the biggest groups of Christian banks were the banks that went to... make up Barclays, but that's another story for another time.
Right.
But the programme explained that in the 19th and 18th century, bankers were actually, I know this sounds unlikely, held up as kind of great moral examples to everybody else. So the bankers, people like Angela Burdett Coutts, who was Coutts, and others, including the Hoare family.
They weren't interested in me banking there, right?
No, Roger, there's a theme there. There's a theme. So... They viewed, the money that they'd been given as a responsibility to use to build all kinds of things. So the Hoare family, for example, were big backers of Wilberforce, and which will come on to later when I was ill. I suddenly realised I was treated at the Royal Marsden, and I suddenly realised all the wards were like named after our competitors. It was like Burdett Ward, Coutts Ward, and so on. And actually, Angela Burdett Coutts gave the land to build the Royal Marsden.
Huh.
So, up until recently, bankers viewed the money that they got, their own money, not other people's, as a chance to help others and help society.
Well, the co-op had a Methodist minister advising them.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Was that the wrong thing to say again?
Actually, he was from Yorkshire,
I think.
He was,
I know. It's dreadful. We will have another side to the coin tomorrow.
Do you know what? We're not being recorded here. Maybe we are. We actually had him to lunch at the bank.
Really?
We should have maybe checked what he was up to in the toilets
beforehand.
Think we should.
Let's go back to... Yes, all right. So, your CEO... presumably, there are massive pressures on you to sort of compromise Christian principles because you're out to make money.
Actually, in Hoare Bank, not, because of the values of the family are such that they're not out to. But in I've worked for 25, 30 years in other banks, and there definitely the mantra is, profit maximization. And that is a challenge to combine with your Christian faith. And the truth is that... as a Christian, you become very conscious that you get it wrong and you screw things up. And, the Christian faith is not for good people, it's for bad people. You go to hospital if you need treatment. If you're well, you don't need to go to hospital. So, I could write a book, and one or two other people in my family, including my wife is here, could probably write more about the mistakes, I've made and the things I've got wrong. And I'll give you an example would be, I went to business school, to INSEAD. I don't know if any of you know, it's a rather prestigious business school in France, and did an MBA there. And I really got it wrong, and I irritated my wife to distraction by just, being obsessed with working and working every hour and not, paying enough attention to her. And even in the holidays from INSEAD, I then went to work for an investment bank, which was kind of a stupid thing to do in retrospect. So being a Christian is absolutely not about being a good person. It's about realizing, look, we're all flawed sinners, all of us. Maybe bankers are sort of top of the list, but everybody else is.
Well, yeah, I'll come on to your Christian faith in a moment. But why do you think bankers are top of the list? What went wrong those years ago with the crash? You know, we've read about it, we've experienced some of the effects of it, but what do you think fundamentally was the cause of it all?
Yeah, well, the short answer, Roger, is it's a bit like the film or the book, you know, The Murder on the Old Orient Express. Have you, any of you read that?
Well, there's 13 murderers.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry to spoil it for you. If you've got it at home, you're going to watch it afterwards. But basically, everybody did it. So the truth is that everybody did it, but I would put the banking profession kind of first in the queue. So look, on the banking side, greed is a powerful motivator. So if people, you know, want to maximize their bonus, there was a case recently, you know, with Barclays where a guy fixed, just in the last few weeks, where a guy fixed the gold price in order to generate, you know, a bonus of £1 million. So if greed becomes, you know, the dominant principle in your life and you just want to maximize the amount of money you take, then it's kind of the devil take the hindmost. Secondly, you know, the regulators were asleep at the switch. They're making up for it since. But, you know, there was all this talk about a light touch and that seems to have gone away. But thirdly, just to blame, you know, to say, well, the bankers are all awful. Well, what did this, because basically the 2008 crash was called the credit crunch. And, you know, there was a very, very extended period of very cheap credit. And all kinds of people, including most people in the UK, I'm not saying everybody in this room, I'm sure you're all very solvent and creditworthy.
No, I could tell you about one or two.
Yeah. If you were talking to my sister again, So, you know, the average level of consumer debt to GDP in the UK went up tremendously over 20 years. And the interesting thing is it hasn't come down that much. So, yes, the banks were primarily responsible, but they were basically pumping out, you know, credit into the economy, and that led to a consumer credit boom. And the ironic thing is, since 2008, you know, are the bankers really sorry? I'm not sure they are. They're sorry they were, we were caught, but I'm not sure that's necessarily the same as being truly sorry. And the central government have basically kept interest rates extremely low through a process called quantitative easing, which we probably shouldn't go into, but we, you know. And that has meant that the availability of credit at a cheap rate, you know, has generally been maintained. So I'm not sure, to anticipate maybe your next question, have we fixed the issues that caused the credit crunch? I don't think so. I suspect at some point each bubble tends to contain the seeds of the next one.
Do you get tired of being caricatured in the way that we do caricature bankers?
No, I think a lot of it is absolutely fair. And I think we have a lot to be criticised about as a profession.
All right, so now you are a Christian. I'm going to ask in a minute how you became a Christian, but how does being a Christian impact the way you do your job?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, as I said earlier, as a Christian, you have to start with yourself. You know, what is it? If you point the finger at somebody, you have a finger pointing out, four pointing back. So when you get things wrong and you treat people the wrong way, and that's the hardest thing, frankly. You've got to be able to go and say, look, I'm sorry, I screwed up, or I shouldn't have done that. I don't like doing that, but that's, I think, an important principle. I think using the money that God's given you, you know, in line with what we were talking about, bankers are not the worst paid profession. Obviously, there are a few even higher, like teachers, but on the whole, yeah. So,
and vicars, we've got some of those here.
So if God's given you all that money, you've got to try and use it, you know, for a good purpose. And then I think also to try and explain your Christian faith to your friends and colleagues. So what we do there, for example, is about once a month, there's about four or five of us. We just have a little dinner party. There's a man called David Jackman, who some of you know. He comes and we just go through a chapter of you know, John's gospel at a time. There's something that I don't know if you do here, but lots of churches do, called kind of one-to-one, which is basically just like a kind of real, you know, two people sitting together and you just, you know, go through a chapter of John's gospel at a time. And I would say to any of you who've come here, been brought by a Christian friend, ask them afterwards, yeah, can you do that? Can you just tell me what each chapter of the Bible is about? They'll be extremely confident and nod, you know, that, yeah, no problem whatsoever. But that I think is an important thing that as a Christian we should be able to explain what the Christian message is.
Incidentally, we do have the one-to-one books on the bookstore,
good.
So
excellent.
Thank you very much.
Are they
I'll
on offer?
See you later.
Yeah, yeah.
They are on offer,
yeah.
Yes. Jeremy, were you brought up in a Christian home?
Yes, I was. My father was the word eccentric doesn't even begin to describe him. He was a real character. So every summer he used to pack his Austin 1800. Most of you look too young to remember that, but some of you, it's probably the worst designed product that British Leyland ever made. It's saying something. He'd pack it all up with myself, my three sisters, my mother, and lots of Russian, Czech, Romanian Bibles, and we go Bible smuggling in Russia. Which
this is when it was communist and Bibles were illegal.
I believe it or not, that was that lot. Yes, I know, I look young. It was in the 70s, that's yes. Right. So what struck me there was just why are these people following Jesus Christ when they have every human reason not to do that? So often we go to churches where the pastor would be in a Siberian labor camp. For all the young people who were in the church, they knew that automatically by going to church, that meant, you know, they couldn't go to university, they couldn't get a job, they couldn't be part of the Communist Party. They were almost like the kind of, you know, untouchables in Indian society where you're basically just at the bottom. So there's every human reason not to go, and yet the churches were packed, absolutely heaving with people. And, you know, it did cross my mind, well, why are these people here? There must be a reason. There must be a reason why they're taking all that cost.
All right, so that made you think, but thinking about God and the motivation of others living for God doesn't make you a Christian.
No.
So what crossed you over the line, Jeremy?
And in fact, to be honest, Roger, I hated going to church. I used to have to go twice. I mean, it's terrible. And Sunday school as well. I thought it was extremely boring and tedious, and I objected in the strongest possible terms to going.
Were you what you would call in your trade an awkward customer?
Well, yeah. Have you met my sisters?
I have. Yeah, and yeah. I got similar vibes.
They made me
yes.
look like Mother Teresa. So yeah. But one day something strange happened to me. To me, it was just like a kind of not real, and not. I didn't. I just went because we had to. And one day, it was nothing to do with my father. It was just somebody else in the church, a man who's, I'm sure, long dead. I think, if I recall, he was actually in the, you know, Desert Rats in the army in the war. And he was just kind of explaining the Bible. And it was as if a kind of, I don't mean literally, but it was as if a kind of hand reached out of the Bible and kind of grabbed me. And I suddenly realized that actually it was true. When I say it was true, because there's all kinds of things in the Bible that, you know, as a teenager, and now you don't understand, but that Jesus Christ was really God. And I would say it was as if a blindfold was lifted from my eyes, but I didn't realize that I was blind. It was only then, in actually meeting Jesus Christ, that I became a Christian. And, you know, there are lots of strange things about the church that put people off. I mean, the church I was in, it was full of, you know, odd people, and that was just my family. And you think, you know, these people are playing weird, and there's, you know, why are they standing up? Why do they sing these strange things? All of that is really irrelevant. The central core of the Christian faith is Jesus Christ the Son of God? Because if he is, then all the other stuff is really secondary stuff that's just stop us seeing the primary thing, which is Jesus. And being a Christian is seeing him. I don't mean literally, I never had a vision or anything dramatic like that, but suddenly realizing, as I described as a teenager, that he is God.
How old were you?
I forget, Roger, so long ago.
Young teenager, older teenager?
A younger teenager, yeah.
All right, now, once you've, as it were, seen God like this, you've trusted in the fact that Jesus loved you, he died for you, he rose, he's your Lord and Saviour, that's going to make an impact at school, at university, and through your work. At school, how was it?
I was a pretty terrible Christian, to be honest.
Yeah. Were you?
I was embarrassed. I mean, my father used to stand on a soapbox in the market in Hempstead every Saturday and kind of preach out the good word. And he used to believe in kind of rent a crowd, so we had to kind of, as children, go along to pretend to be like passers-by who'd stop. So I thought that was terrible, you know. That was social suicide, you know. Why would I want to stand there? So, but God, when God draws you to himself, it's like a fisherman. He just kind of gradually reels you in. And then he begins to kind of interfere in your life and change you. And you don't like it, but he does it. And that's a long, drawn-out process. So becoming a Christian, it's about knowing that Jesus Christ is God, but it's also about then following him and obeying him. And by nature, I don't like to do that, because I'm sure all of you are very mild and biddable. I like to be the boss, sorry to say. I like to, you know, decide what to do. But part of being Christian is to say, no, I'm not the boss, God, you're the boss, and I'll follow you. For example, on your money. So it's a struggle sometimes. Do I spend money on this or on that? And you've got to try and bow the knee to Jesus. The truth is, Roger, as you know, every day we screw up and we get it wrong. So every day you've got to keep short accounts with God.
By that you mean just come clean with him and say, sorry, I've messed up again. Yeah. University, where did you go to university?
Well, despite going to a very not the highest quality, kind of bog standard comprehensive, I did manage to scrape into Cambridge. I think it was an administrative error, actually.
What did Leeds turn you down then?
Yeah. And Huddersfield as well.
And what did you study?
Well, I studied history, yeah, hence the being terrible at maths, you see.
And how was Christian living at university?
That was great, actually. There were lots of really cool people. For the first time in my life, I met cool people who were Christians. I never met any before, apart from my sisters, of course.
Are you the youngest?
I know I look like that, actually. I'm the oldest.
Everybody makes
the same mistake, yeah. Roger. It's very easy. So that was really... And there was a kind of vibrancy and a life about the Christians at university. And also, students are really willing to debate, you know, endlessly anything. So, yeah, it was... It was a fantastic experience. Really, really. As a Christian, I kind of deepened my faith very much there.
Okay, because for some people, you sort of feel that university could be a time when people, I don't know, question and lose their faith, but it was exactly the opposite for you.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, one of the things about the whole banking crisis is this sort of loss of trust, not just towards bankers, but towards politicians and towards the media, and then we get the stories of the entertainers and medical things, etc. And trust seems to have just collapsed. Do you at all wonder, am I misplacing my trust when I put my trust in God, in Jesus? Could I have been being fooled? Am I making something that will end up in catastrophe and disappointment?
Yeah, you do sometimes wonder that, especially in the tough things in life, because being a Christian is not an insurance policy where you can suddenly say, no, hang on a minute, God, you can't do this to me. Like the story about being fired. So I used to pray every day, God, don't let me be fired, but I was. So, you know, okay. I lived to tell the tale. So, yeah, you do... When everything's going well, then that question doesn't cross. But when tough things happen, then you can doubt God's existence, or you think, well, if there is a God, how can he treat me like this? Because I am, self-centered, and we all tend to think of everything in terms of what does it mean? What does it mean for me?
Now, it's not just about money and about being fired, but for you, the big C, cancer, became an issue, didn't it? Tell us what happened, Jeremy.
So, yeah, about 2 years ago, I just was having a shower and just noticed this sort of very small lump here on my ribs. So, listen here, gents, always listen to your wife. So the boss said, you should go and get that checked out. So I said, yavol, and went straight...
Is that her name?
Yeah, okay, that's right. I went straight to the GP. He said, oh... Don't worry, it's absolutely nothing. How old are you? 50? Don't worry, everybody gets these fatty lumps. It's absolutely nothing, but we'll get it checked out. When eventually, after quite a while, the Marsden diagnosed it. The expert there said, I wouldn't blame the GP, it was a kind of rare type of cancer, which the average GP will see one of in a 40-year career. Mm. So, you know, you go around, some of you have probably been to this, and you go through different tests, and each time they say, more tests are required, which is a very helpful answer. And, yeah, eventually they said, okay, it's cancer. So then I had a couple of operations, and then I had radiotherapy, but I feel very fortunate. I never had to have chemo. I have a very impressive scar.
No, thank you. No.
It's sort of like a giant shark bite. Yeah, so it's quite...
Oh, okay, I've never seen one of those either, but anyway.
But that was about a year ago, and I feel great now. I go back by every 3-4 months for tests, which I don't think about it that much until you go for the checkup, and then the days before you think,
what if? Yeah. But now, seriously, you know, to be told you've got cancer, I've never had cancer, but my wife has on a couple of occasions, and to be told you've got cancer is quite devastating, really. You've already talked about a Damocles sword. It's another one. How did you react? As a Christian, how did you react?
When you're told it, it is devastating because you think, I may die. And then you go to the doctor and he says, these are your chances. And, you know, none of us don't want to die, do you? Especially we've got 3 children. You don't want to say goodbye to your wife and children. So it shakes you. Literally, it's shaking. You can... It's an acid test of your Christian faith, because it's all very well to say, you know, I believe in God and I believe in Jesus Christ, which I do. But here is something that isn't theoretical. It's real, and it's staring you in the face. So Roger and I were talking earlier about, you know, what maybe Bible passage Roger was going to cover. Mm. And I said that when this happened to me, a passage that spoke to me really powerfully, really powerfully. Again, as if this hand... I know this sounds sort of weird, but it's when the Bible comes to life, it's as if a kind of, you feel this is actually God, the maker of the universe, speaking directly to me. Mm. So this passage on the storm, because if you remember the story, Jesus is asleep and suddenly a great storm blows up, just like that. And that's the same with cancer. One day everything is fine and suddenly you've got cancer. So the storm blows up and God, Jesus, appears to be asleep. And what you do, you doubt God's character, because that's what the disciples do. They shook him roughly and said, oi, wake up, don't you care that we're going to drown? Now Jesus wakes up and he stills the storm. But sometimes, and you know, we've got Christian friends who are going through this, God doesn't wake up or doesn't appear to wake up, because, you know, I hope I'm cured from cancer. I don't know if I am or not, but I hope I am. But sometimes there are Christians, and I know them, who have, you know, died of cancer. So, you know, what then? Well, you know, the story doesn't end with Jesus stilling the storm. It ends with they came to the other side. So, as a Christian, I believe that when I die, because we're all going to die sooner or later of cancer or something else, that he will bring me to the other side to be with him. And when I was being treated at the Marsden and lying there for radiotherapy, this may sound rather bizarre, but I thought, I'll memorize a psalm. Okay, why not? So I thought, I'll memorize Psalm 34, which I'm sure you know by heart, Roger. So, yeah.
Well, just remind me.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the verses in it, and as I was, because if you go to radiotherapy, you can't move, so you have to lie there, kind of like you can't twitch a muscle, was Psalm 34, those who look to him, their faces are radiant, which is quite an appropriate verse if you go through radiotherapy, because, you know, if you go through radiotherapy, you kind of get radiant.
I've never read it like that before,
radiant.
But I will remember.
And in that moment, and other times, I felt powerfully that Jesus Christ was in that radiotherapy operating theatre. And you may say, well, it's weird, I didn't see anything, but I felt that he was there. And death is a terrible enemy, and it's something we all have to face sooner or later. If you're a Christian, you have someone who's gone ahead of you, who's not only gone through it, but has come back. Mm. Nobody in human history has done that. No person has gone to death and come back, but Jesus has. Not only that, not only has he gone to death, he's conquered death. And that is an amazing hope. Otherwise, life is pretty depressing. I mean, you know, we all get...
hung up, don't we, in our work, and we spend time on, you know, emails and other stupid stuff. But at the end of it, there's a kind of big cliff which we're all going over. Well, someone came back from that cliff. And I believe with all my heart that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And more than that, I believe that if you speak to him and you speak to God and you say, God, I'm not sure if you're there, but if you are there, show yourself to me, that he will show himself to you.
Hmm. Jeremy, to be honest, what's come across? You see a CEO of a bank, and yet there's a vulnerability. We almost feel that you're unassailable in that position, but no, you're a real man, and there is a vulnerability, and yet there is this genuine confidence in Jesus Christ. But you must be mixing with people who are incredibly cynical about your Christian faith and about Christian faith altogether. How do fellow bankers regard you?
Well, it's funny, because when I was ill, I originally wrote two emails. I wrote an email to my Christian friends saying, please pray for me, and I wrote an email to non-Christians just saying, and I thought, I'll stuff it, I'll just write one. So I wrote one email, and I said, you know, please pray. And one of my friends, he lives in Cambridge, he's a real out-and-out atheist, you know, we always discussed Dawkins. He sent me this reply, which really, really touched me. He said, this morning I gave God a surprise. I went into a church in Cambridge and prayed for you.
Oh, really? Amazing.
Yeah, so people do. Yeah. When you're, you know, what is it? There are no atheists in foxholes. Mm. So I felt that he was in that. He hasn't become a Christian or anything, but I felt that was a... When you're going through something like cancer, the kind of veils and sort of masks that we all try and put on are to some extent stripped away. But yeah, lots of people in the city are not interested in God, in Jesus Christ. The main reason is they already have a God, which is money. I mean, I think all of us are made to worship something. And if we do, you know, we have a kind of hole in our life that we want to put the most significant thing. That's what worship means, really, to say this is the thing I kind of orientate my life around. So if we say there's no God, then we'll put something else there. We'll put money or family or happiness or something there. So most of those people that I know, you know, they're not happy because if you have 10 million, you want more, you have 50, 100, people just want more and more. And it's kind of like, especially it's a guy thing, I'm not saying women can't be like that, but men kind of, it's like playing cricket, you kind of score runs basically by making money. So that's the big obstacle to in the city to people becoming Christians, I think, that they just love money more.
So just on the women being like that, Mae West was once asked, if you could have £10 million or 10 children, which would you like? And she said, oh, 10 children, to which the interviewer said, why? She said, if I had 10 children, I wouldn't want any more. it's the same point, isn't it? But then how as a Christian can you justify working in that world?
Well, I think there's a real misunderstanding that somehow there are some professions, I don't know why teaching springs to mind, but it does, which are kind of inherently Christian.
Your sisters are having a bad time.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. This is my kind of chance to have a go. Yeah. Or you know, medical stuff. Mm. And that, you know, other professions, business especially, is kind of somehow unchristian. Not at all. The Bible is full of stuff about money and business. I mean, 45% of Jesus' parables are about money and possessions. Mm. So there's nothing wrong with any profession. I mean, there may be one or two professions like kind of drug dealing, which probably you shouldn't have Christians in. One or two of you might think banking is not a million miles away from that. Anyway. No, Christians should be out into every profession that's legally available and try and be salt and light and try and also change those professions for good, because let's face it, you know, banking especially needs that. So, you know, because my father was a pastor, lots of people used to say, oh, Jeremy, you'll become a pastor. But I never felt that was what I should do. I felt, no, I should stick to making lots of money.
Time's gone, but quickly, you say you can face death without fear?
No, I didn't say that.
Well, what were you saying?
No, I think anybody who says that is a liar. No, it's even as a Christian, death is a terrible enemy, and it's fearful. And it's...
But is that more the process of death rather than wondering what's going to happen after death?
It's a struggle, Roger. So on the one hand, you have your faith and you have the Bible. And on the other hand, yeah, it's... I guess it is the process, yeah, especially with cancer. If you've seen people die in cancer, it's not great. But, again... I felt, and other Christians feel, that then God speaks personally to you. And how does he do that? He speaks to you through the Bible. Mm. So if you want to get to know God, if you want to, is there a God, is there not, read one of the Gospels. It doesn't matter which one, you know, any of the four. And if you read it in an open way, I honestly promise you that God will speak to you. Whether you answer and whether you do something is up to you. But that to me is the way then, that is a kind of, that's the safety net. It's basically that, I mean, it's nothing magical about the Bible. The Bible is a means to an end, and the end of the Bible is Jesus Christ. So when you're in a deep problem like cancer, open up the Bible and it's all there. And God speaks to you. And again, that hand comes out and touches you and reaches you about Jesus Christ.
Hmm. And lastly, supposing you have another 50 years, what are your dreams? What are your hopes, your desires, ambitions for the future? What do you want for the future?
Oh, maybe that's a different. You didn't warn me about that question. No. I honestly haven't really thought about it much, Roger, to be honest.
Well, look, if you want an answer, you will be around afterwards, yeah. Won't you? You've got. I won't preach for more than a couple of hours, so you've got some time to think of an answer. Go up
I'll
and ask
that.
Him. Let's thank Jeremy, shall we? Thank you very much. Thank you. Very good.